Welcome, welcome. You're listening to our podcast, Two Massage Therapists and a Microphone. My name is Mark. I'm a registered massage therapist, registered kinesiologist here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. We got a real cool... This is a double take, man. This is like a double header today.
You're the second bum in that seat today.
Is it warm? Is it warm?
No, but what do you mean second bum? I'm not a fucking bum. Don't say that about me.
Well, that's debatable. I think that might be depending on who we ask.
All right. Well, I might have a nice one, but it doesn't mean I'm a bum.
Well, I don't know. Let's stand up. Let's see.
How did we get here?
Well, I don't know. You know what?
I'm not partaking. You
sprint, don't you?
I sure do.
All right. So we've got another bum in the seat, and it's
a nice one, apparently.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I would maybe say sexy, but...
Listen,
but I won't.
You did, and I appreciate it.
You know, I accidentally sexually harassed our first guest today.
So you know we're also doing Facebook Live on this one.
I know.
All right, cool.
Our first guest today turned over to like pick something up, and just at the same time, I was like setting up my headphones or something. No, even worse, the back of my hand like grazed her butt as she turned over, and I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
So you called attention to it.
But that's that's an accident. That's not harassment.
It was a joke, bum in the seat.
Well,
okay. Well,
I think if that happened at a couple people's workplaces, you might end up in HR, whether it was an accident or not.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Especially when it's not a hands-on therapeutic setting.
We got a cool guest sitting with us. His name is Sam. And Amanda, why don't you tell everyone why Sam's back in the hot seat, like, so soon?
I can do that. Yeah, it wasn't even that long ago. When did we record last?
It would have been some point in the summer. I don't remember exactly when.
That sounds absolutely correct. Well, I am tired. Jeez. It's Amanda. It is Tuesday night, and this is the second recording that we're doing today. And Sam was here in the summer, as he said. He's also been on another episode a while back. Is this your third or fourth now? I think it's my second.
I've done a decent amount of filming.
Did you not do a podcast before this last one?
I don't think so.
No.
Really?
Yeah, yes. This is number two.
But if I have my way,
to be familiar with the catalog.
Yeah. But also, don't worry about
huge.
That.
Give me a break.
She sees me a lot.
Okay.
But in an interesting way.
And you didn't notice his glutes before then?
I try not to stare at our...
No one said stare. Why does it equate to stare?
Noticing.
Noticing you, noticing me. Yeah, all that.
Very nice.
All that jazz. Sam's back because...
Why are you back?
He was listening to some of our recent episodes, both with Anne and with Marvin, regarding education. And as some of you may know from his episode, which was called I'm Opening a School. I'm Opening a School. And...
So you do know the catalog.
I do know.
Yes.
He owns osteopathy. Lyceum, and this is a osteopathic school for registered massage therapists. And so listening to those episodes,
people with previous healthcare backgrounds. Yeah. RMTs are the most ideal candidates.
Yes. But don't worry. We won't shun you out, nurses and others like that. So Sam was listening to those episodes with Anne and with Marvin, and he heard his name come up because Mark made a really good point when we were talking to Marvin that Sam said it best. RMT formal education is to create really good novices.
Yes.
And so that sparked a little more discussion.
That came out in your talk, the Massage Therapy Media Talk lecture series at the Canadian Massage Conference. That's where I noticed that.
So then Sam heard this, sent me a message.
Did you do that talk just on the fly? Or did you
absolutely.
Have something prepared?
No, it was absolutely on the fly.
Yeah, okay.
So
everything he does is on the fly.
Well, and the reason for that is I have a general framework that I can plug most things into.
Right.
So you can hang most details on, but it connects. It's kind of omnipresent. And as a result of that, wherever I end up being, I'm able to pull in the appropriate details and hang it on the proper framework. The other thing is that my development as an educator happened in a way where PowerPoints were very much frowned upon. So you had to know your stuff and you had to just be able to go. The best example of this, I was helping on a course in Japan. And on the final day, I had been assisting. And on the final day, the person that had that I had gone there with, we had both been brought, well, he had been brought over and I was there to assist him. Okay. And we were about, as the sliding door to the van opened, he said, "You're up, you're doing this." So I've never worked through a translator before, but I knew the translator, I knew the material, so I was able to go. But under the circumstances, because it was going through translation, there was a PowerPoint which I had prepared, so I knew the material.
Right.
But it's like, you just got to go.
Would you rather be prepared or would you rather just rock and roll?
So I think the best way to put it is I'm always ready. So I can rock and roll.
We've talked about Sam on other episodes.
What about you? Would you rather prep something or would you rather just do it on the go?
Are you asking me because you are curious or do you want me to tell the world? Because I feel like if you know me at all, you know the answer to that question.
Well,
that was mean, eh? Like, as a wife, that was mean.
Listen,
most things I ask you on this is I know the answer to. Yeah,
but okay. He's also a vibe setter. Like, come on.
I know. I'm saying that was mean because if he didn't know, then like he looks like a crappy husband. But no, he does know. I prep nothing for anything I do. I mean, I've been invited on other people's podcasts. I've been invited to speak at things. Somebody will say like, "Hey, can you come do a presentation on XYZ?" And I might, like you were saying, if I have a PowerPoint created, I kind of have an idea what's there. I don't pay attention to the slides. Anytime I've had to jump in and teach for Mark, majority of the Con Ed Institute classes, he created them. He created the PowerPoints. I've TA'd on almost all of them. And so if I have to jump in and teach something, in the beginning, I used to actually like try to look at the notes and follow the notes. And I'm like, no, I know what this is. And that's just more confusing. Let's just keep going. So I prep for nothing.
I don't like to prep for anything just because I'm lazy. And I feel like I just do a better job when I just feel when I can free flow.
So there's a thing that I think I'm observing appropriately in a lot of circumstances. So if you look at, say, it was Anne and Marvin, those were the two people you've had the conversations with that I was tuning into. One of the things that I think you'll notice often is people won't explicitly understand what they've done, but over time, you go from novice to expert. And in that process, you understand the details. You have been forced into situations where you have to bring in one detail, you make a mistake, now you got to bring in another one. The other thing is that with respect to certain forms of delivery, have you heard of cognitive load?
I've probably heard of a lot of things and I just don't know the formal terms for them.
Yeah, and this is actually what I mean. So in your experience teaching, how useful is the PowerPoint? Is the PowerPoint useful or is the PowerPoint kind of an attention splitter? What have you seen so far?
I can see it go both ways.
Yeah. And it depends on the person, right?
Yeah, it all depends on the person.
So that's one of the challenges. So the term cognitive load is essentially talking about it. As an analog, you'd be thinking about RAM,
right?
Random access memory in a computer. Yep. So the higher the cognitive load, the harder time somebody's going to have more or less ingesting the information and doing anything with it. So you have two types of cognitive load. Currently, most people will talk about three. So the intrinsic cognitive load is how complicated the topic is, how many elements are playing against each other,
okay. Right?
The extrinsic load is how complicated has somebody presented it to you. Mm-hmm. So the more moving parts, the more pieces of information, the more confusing the language, the higher the extrinsic load goes. The germane load is essentially related to both of those previous ones. It's how much processing do you have to do to take it in.
Right.
So if it is complicated in and of itself, it's harder to deal with. If somebody presents it complicated, so if it isn't complicated and somebody presents it complicated, it gets worse. Mm. If it is complicated and somebody presents it complicated, it's really bad.
Right.
So if it is complicated and somebody's able to present it in a way that you can take it on, at least to start, and then they can add more layers. Mm-hmm. So the idea of repetition, the idea of recursive returning, that would be important. So how many times have you experienced a slide and you look at it and you're like, what kind of Rorschach test is this? Like, and you've both probably also come across people trying to teach how to make a good slide, right? Like, you know, it should just be bullet points. You shouldn't be reading quotes, things of that nature.
Yep.
That is going to be best explained by the concepts and challenges with cognitive load, right? So if you understand cognitive load, then as an educator, your delivery has the opportunity to change to make it more ingestible and digestible by the learner. So the other thing is when you're teaching something live, when you're teaching to the crowd, they've never experienced the details before, each person is going to take it in differently.
Absolutely.
Right. So before I continue to doing exactly what I'm doing, and this is what I always do, the main point in relation to the thing that piqued my interest when you both noted that I had said that massage education is primarily aimed at making a really good novice, mm-hmm. is to speak to the fundamentals of learning and the fundamentals of educational delivery, as well as the tension between the administrator and the educator.
Right.
Right? So education and administration are not the same thing. Right. So when they mix, you're going to have tension. You're going to have problems. But the fundamental learning mechanisms are exceptionally important. Administrators will make you do administrative tasks. As long as it's on paper, their butts are covered.
Yep.
And then when you actually walk into a classroom, that's not actually what's happening. However, you can just point at the paper and say that you hit all the marks.
Right.
Right. That's unfortunately how that goes. Right. Good, bad, or indifferent. Think whatever you want. If you're more of an administrator, you're like, no, it must be done. If you're more of an educator, you're like, get them off my back.
Yep.
Right. So the classic thing in education, as far as, say, resources are concerned. So if you think about live teaching would be considered a synchronous resource. Mm-hmm. Synchronous being it occurs at the same time. Right. Asynchronous resources are at varying times, right? So your classic synchronous resource is the sage on the stage, the person teaching the details right in front of you. You have this wide variety of people there. So essentially, you're utilizing time to deliver the details, which is a classic way, and it's clearly worked. Mm-hmm. It has definitely worked across the ages because we didn't have as many ways to go asynchronous.
Right.
There was high cost. There was high labor. You couldn't produce enough of them. So your classic asynchronous resources are things like textbooks and assignments. So assignments being homework, being papers, whatever. That's an asynchronous resource. The very difficult thing for teachers to figure out is that when the students perform well on the test, they think it's because of the synchronous activity. Mm. They think it's because of the synchronous delivery. But if that synchronous delivery, if it's very easy to see that people take it in differently, what you don't see as a teacher is that diligent students go home and do most of the work on their own.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They rely on the asynchronous resources. The asynchronous resources, again, primarily being your textbooks or your common learning resources. So textbooks, assignments, things like that.
You know, that's how I really survived most of my post-secondary education.
It's how everybody does it.
Like, yeah, I mean, there are people, I don't know if that's everybody, but maybe
oh, no.
You're right. You know more things. You own a school. But
when I
was in school, whether it was, university, college, I found it very difficult to really absorb. Well, even when I was in my labs, sometimes I found it really difficult to absorb what was happening. I would go in, I would do the experiments, I'd pick up pieces here and there, but it wasn't until I went back home and then reviewed the lab that I just did, reviewed the experiment, like looked at the results again, compared it to the research that we had already been discussing in class. Like I had to do all of this puzzle piecing together afterwards. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sure, like my biomechanics exams in university were great. But in the moment, like in the biomechanics lab, I felt like a fish out of water. I'm like, I have no idea what's happening right now.
Do you think you're a different learner now, though, that you're older? I was probably like that as well, where the asynchronous learning was the thing. Not anymore. Now I think synchronous learning, I'm right there with it. And I never thought I would have been like that. Yeah.
What do you think changed?
I don't know. Oh, I have no idea. I've never
think he knows.
I've never stopped to try to analyze it. I've just accepted it.
He'll do it for you.
Yeah, well, so here's the deal. This is where I can invoke the Socratic method. Mm. I can ask questions. So if I give you the concept of, so you already understand the concept of synchronous and asynchronous resources. Mm. You understand the concept of a scaffolding. Is that fair? Mm. Like an educational scaffolding or a framework.
Yeah, okay.
Right? So if I suggest that everybody is going to develop a framework, whether one is delivered to them or not,
okay,
would you accept that you've developed a framework for understanding most things over time?
Yep.
Right? So if you have that framework, what are you going to do with live details?
I get it now.
You're going to hang it on that framework.
Yep.
Now, whether or not your framework is fantastic, whether or not your framework is good, whether or not other people can tune into it appropriately, you have it.
Yep.
Now, the term would be semantic network or network of related meaning. So you have a category. That category could be effleurage, right? Now, effleurage, while it is a straightforward category, the manner in which you actually have to physically move to do effleurage to one muscle versus another has differences in detail, right? But that category is the same no matter what. There is something that is the same. That is why we can call it effleurage,
right?
That's why I can call it a direct barrier method in osteopathic methodology, right? An indirect barrier methodology goes under the same category, which is basically it's making you make a choice of don't make the patient say ouch, right? So it was actually Paul Kohlmeier. I'm saying his last name properly?
Yes, correct.
Okay, I just want to make sure. I like the guy. I don't want to mess up his name.
You did a good job.
Sweet. He was talking about noxious and non-noxious stimuli to the patient for varying reasons. And I was like, noxious? Like, you guys actually think about this? And talk? I didn't know this. I didn't know that that was a discussion in the massage therapy world. But now, it may not be a big discussion, but for somebody, at least maybe in cupping.
Yeah.
Right? So the fact that that's a discussion is really interesting to me because I didn't know that detail before, but I have a framework through which I can interpret it, because what I will say about osteopathy versus other hands-on professions is that the primary difference is osteopathy purposely tries to not make the patient say ouch, right? That's the barrier concept. So if I take it one way and they say ouch, well, I go the other way or I do a different thing. So the direct barrier is the restricted barrier. I'll take it there. If they say ouch, I'll either go short of where they say ouch,
right,
or I will make the soft tissue go soft. That's indirect, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a framework, but it doesn't matter what method I'm looking at. When I'm looking at it, I know what the person is doing. I know the choice they're making. We may speak about it differently, but I have a framework through which to interpret it. So that's going to relate to the movement from novice to expert, right? Novices are procedural. Experts are outcome-based.
Can I ask a question before we go too far on this? I just want to make sure I'm following everything. Foot. You did touch my foot. At least it wasn't my butt cheek like I did to our guest earlier. So, you know, it's fine. It's just my toe. Everyone's fine. When you started explaining, when you're like, I know why. Mm-hmm. Are you now explaining to us why Mark's learning style may have changed, like having this framework versus when he was, you know, maybe younger in university? Are these things related yet?
Yeah.
Okay. So the reason I'm asking that is because are we now strictly talking about learning something that's building on a framework that already exists? Like what if he's, I mean, complete novice and he's learning something that he's never had exposure to? Does any of this still apply?
So the fundamental mechanism of learning is being able to identify that you didn't hit the mark, right? So if you missed the target, first of all, you have to know that there is a target. Secondly, you have to be able to detect that you missed the target. If you don't know, you won't learn. It's not possible, right? One of the things that makes learning work better is previous exposure to a topic. Mm-hmm. That's moving from novice to expertise. So if babies are complete novices in almost everything. It takes a long time to get them to understand that there is a target and that they've missed it. When they know they missed it, they'll correct. So if you look at fundamental neurological research, and usually it's target acquisition or target hitting, right? So it's kind of motor. What the heck? What's wrong with me? There's a proper term for it, but like, I can't get it. But yeah, like
he's lost his words.
Yeah, my English is not so good looking. Or I can't remember. It was the Oscars, and
suddenly you turned into Pedro from.
Well, there was another
from
one.
Napoleon Dynamite.
Remember Il Postino when the Italian guy won, and he like gives this fantastic speech. He's like, "I have run out of English." Yeah, it's
like
motor control. They're all neurological, but anyways, yeah, like. And motor control is going to be appropriate enough. There's a more accurate term. Okay. But basically, you're doing neurological stuff. You're studying the nerves and how they're functioning and varying things. When somebody misses a target really quickly, there's varying things. So if you're doing kind of surface, like EMG on the head, you'll see a spike when they miss, and then really quickly you'll see a correction spike. Like you'll see very – there's like – it's ERP. It's – something related potential. I can't remember what the E is. Okay. Error related potential. So if you ever care to look up my thesis at McMaster, you go to MaxSphere and you look up Samuel Jarman, you'll find my thesis, ERP. It's error related potential, I believe. It's talking about error detection in neurological research. So there are signals that show you that somebody knows that they made an error. It's really easy to figure out when you know that the task is to hit the target because you missed the target, right? So what they'll do in a lot of that research is they'll build in a correction, right? So if you shoot straight at it, you miss. So because you see that it goes slightly to the right, you aim slightly to the right. Right. So you have to know that there was an error. So if you look at my thesis, what you'll find is that my primary finding was that there was a particular form of error that I identified in a pilot study. So I tested some people and they would make the same type of error. So they'd find the right thing, the right phenomenon, but they would put it in the wrong category. And by putting it in the wrong category, there's an error. So one group got error correction. So I told, well, they got error identification. So I told them that they made the error and I reminded them about the information they already knew. And the error went away really quickly. The other two groups, because I was trying to figure something else out. Like if you're nice to people, do they perform better? Well, if you're nice to people, they don't perform better. It's because it's an identification task, right? So the unfortunate reality of education is what matters is the required information to perform. What matters less for performance is how you treat people in a very unfortunate way. Because it would be nice to tell people, be nice to your learners, and you want to tell them because it's going to improve their performance. It's going to improve your teaching outcomes.
But it doesn't.
It doesn't. They're two separate things that happen at the same time, unfortunately. So the example that I'll often use is the U.S. women's gymnastics team. Down the line, world and Olympic champions, down the line abuse victims, right? So it's like, ah, crap, they had the appropriate information for the performance and the appropriate skills for the performance, so they did. It's like, yeah, but they're also abuse victims. It's like, yeah, right. It's a very unfortunate phenomenon. It's just that they happen at the same time, so most people would never be able to pick them apart. I couldn't pick them apart until I stumbled on it,
right?
But as far as the errors are concerned, when somebody committed an error and didn't know, they couldn't correct it. So the next time the opportunity to make the error happened, they did it.
Yep.
Right?
Makes sense.
Whereas when the error was identified for them, they corrected it. It basically disappeared, right? Mm-hmm. So as far as learning is concerned, fundamental learning requires the identification or the ability to know that there's a target and to know that there's an error. Now, if you can't figure that out yourself, that's where the instructor who can identify it for you comes in. And this is actually why synchronous time is often misutilized, and good, bad, or indifferent, and a worldwide event that forces people for varying reasons and things that people can say good things and bad things about comes along and forces people home into the virtual environment, and people, as far as education is concerned, primarily start to use the virtual environment in a synchronous fashion. Then you start to really see the value of synchronous and asynchronous resources. Synchronous activity online, as far as teaching is concerned, like delivering details, stinks. And the big problem is engagement. So in a live teaching environment in front of people, you can watch them, you can pick up on a lot of cues that you're not going to pick up on in that virtual environment. So some will have their camera off. Those who do have their camera on, depending on the camera angle and depending on your ability to scan that size screen versus your normal scanning routine through a room, it's going to change. So your ability to manage engagement in the virtual environment is poor. In the live environment, it's better, but there's still a huge variety of engagement with respect to the live environment, right? You've both taught. Mm-hmm. You're really talking to one person and another person. And the reason you'll switch is because it's like that person's kind of there, everything's okay. Then you'll switch over there because you see something going on. There's some cue that grabs you.
Right.
It's just not useful in the online environment. There is research to talk about this. Asynchronous detail delivery is way better. So a video showing the thing that you want them to see that they watch when they want, as much or as little as they want, they take care of the engagement. Guess who's going to watch it more, the diligent or the non-diligent student.
Mm. I suddenly feel so much better about myself as a student. I wasn't the only one not absorbing anything. I shouldn't say anything, but I wasn't leaving any lecture in university like mind blown. Like I really, like I needed to literally go home and like digest things and maybe like review what just happened. Mm-hmm. I don't know if at the time I thought it was me. I was like, why can't I focus? Why can't I understand what's happening right here?
Because you
fully
went to Western and you drank too much.
Well,
that was a factor. Thank you for saying that on Facebook Live.
You know what's interesting? maybe I don't know this. We both went to York.
Yep.
Do you get the impression that at York, at least most of the time, there would be less drinking than at Western within the student population?
He doesn't know. He was always drinking.
I spent a lot of my university years with beers in my system.
Fair enough. Yeah. And the only reason I ask is because my experience, I just didn't notice it, but I also wasn't going out.
My drinking had less to do with the institution.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just a product of being a gigging musician.
I was about to say, yeah, like you were playing bass. So.
Yeah. And I was playing probably four or five nights a week.
Yes. So, yeah. The culture of music requires at least a drink here and there.
At least.
At least.
Listen, I'm also involved in music in a very different way. But like one of the best parts of running a soundboard and running the backing tracks is that at private functions is that I have none of the challenges of being the performer, but all of, like, I have none of the cons and all of the benefits because I get the free drinks.
The drinking with the music, it's just the setup of the whole thing. You show up to the venue at a given time,
like way too early.
Exactly. And then that's when you gotta load in shit, and then there's nothing to do. You sit around and
talk some crap,
and sometimes the bar is open, sometimes it's not, and even if it's not, the bar back is there doing inventory and the bartender's there setting up, and the bartender will serve you because you're there. And then you just drink until sound check.
Yep.
And then you do sound check, and then you still got another couple hours before you actually play. And
your singer never drank. He was always sipping on green tea when I arrived at the venue.
Well, he was really into making sure his voice was proper. So, and he doesn't function well with booze.
Yeah, he never drank.
Now, this is the thing, because I work with singers.
Yep.
So it's like, oh, you're with the band? I'm like, no, I am the band. So what do you play? I play the iPad.
I play the iPad.
Like, literally, this whole thing could go wrong if my finger slips.
Yeah.
It's like, ah, damn it, Sam. But because they're singers, they essentially will not drink before.
No.
They will have what they call a grease cutter. Mm. So they'll have a liquor, like something stronger, just to kind of move the mucus. The other thing, especially I would say with people who are playing instruments, is alcohol can be classified as a substance to change state. So that change of state, that slight change in what's happening internal to you, is probably really useful for playing the instrument. Is that fair?
Yes.
Yeah. So like you just want to be in a slightly different feeling, and then you probably hit flow state easier, or what you feel like flow state.
I do.
Yeah. Maybe, and other people, you've probably seen some musicians who are straight edge.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But, they're also probably just generally neurotic. Like, they're like vegans and CrossFitters.
Yeah.
They're just they're trying to tell you. But, I mean, I don't even know if there's people who will say straight edge anymore.
Probably not.
Yeah, and fair enough. But yeah, the activity in university, as far as, say, engagement within lectures, these are large spaces.
Yeah, they're massive.
Especially in first year in certain programs.
When my biology class, I think, had 800 students.
A lot of people.
You know what kills me? More people are telling me about these 800 seat lecture halls.
Yeah.
York doesn't have 800 seat lecture halls. They have
really?
400.
Yeah, they're
like 400, 450. Yeah.
By the way, don't quote me on 800. I graduated university in 2007. Like, I might not know what I'm talking about right now.
Yeah.
I just remember it was an unreal amount of people that, like, you were completely anonymous. Like, whether I was there or not, I don't even think,
even amongst 400 people.
Even amongst 400 people. It's not like the professor could look out and say, like, oh, there's this many empty. Like, there was just so many people that.
Here's an interesting
engagement.
Yes.
I don't know how there would be engagement in a room like that.
So, under those circumstances, what the heck? And also, how old were you?
Yeah.
I was
19 in that first-year bio class.
How good would your average first-year university student, who's more likely than not to be 19, obviously there's a range. There are people who go back and do undergrads at varying points in their life. But the vast majority of people will be...
I mean, these days they're 17, 18.
It's even worse.
Because there's no...
That,
I had OAC, so I was
like
old.
13.
And how much opportunity have they had to develop the skill set to manage their own engagement, manage their day, their life, and then you put a full course load on them with this variety of topics that maybe they've touched because they met the requirements, but depending on the requirements of the particular program of the particular university, it's highly variable. So, you know, do you remember your goddamn high school teachers saying, "We're preparing you for university"?
No, you fucking didn't.
But they also don't understand the fundamental mechanisms. They stumble, many of them will stumble across good teaching behavior, but sometimes they run into what's called experience utility. So they see the outcomes on tests and they're, say, performing par or above, and they feel like they're doing this awesome job because why wouldn't you? Those are your metrics. That's what you get raises in performance and like raises and promotions on. So if you feel like you're hitting your metrics, why would you ever try to figure out whether or not it's what you're doing or what the student's doing?
Plus, they're the dumbest, laziest people I've ever met in my life.
Sam's gonna stay PC here.
No, so what I
think of everyone that you went to York with that was doing education concurrently, they were the dumbest of the crew.
Yeah, so I didn't actually hang out with many people at York.
I'm kidding, teachers.
No, but I was at the track more.
There you go.
Like I was working out.
All right, that's why that's why the glutes look the way they do.
Yeah, and genetics. my calves are weird and ridiculous, and I've never done a thing for them, but that's so that's genetics, but also the fact that I sprint has done something. But anyways, when I was in school, I remember the people, and you're as a learner, you're like, you hate kids. What are you doing here?
Yeah.
So then I had an experience. My sister in the north end of Whitby in Brooklyn, she was the founding member of the PTA at the school that my nieces and nephews went. Her name's literally on a plaque on the wall. And I had an experience whereby I was helping her with the fall fair. I was just trying to be helpful. And I was in the teacher's lounge and I heard the way the teachers were talking to each other. And I'm like, wow, you guys do hate kids. And then, interestingly, with my daughter, almost all of her teachers I've had positive interactions with, and they have been diligent people. So I've had a really interestingly positive experience with the public teaching profession with my daughter, but my own, I was like, you hate us. So it's interesting. So what I've actually seen is the variety. I've been able to adjust my mental model because I've gotten more information and I've had time to build the familiarity. Guess what? That's novice to expert in framework and semantic networks, right? Like these concepts explain a lot. They help you work through and put constraints on these details that seem like they're all over the place, but you can bring them together.
Okay. I'm going to sound really stupid here, but you're going to follow me.
You're not going to sound stupid. You're going to sound like you have a thing that you're curious about that you'd like to make sense of.
I'm going to sound really stupid here, but you're going to follow me. So I am now a, 30 something, and
I'm 42.
I've lived life. I've had experiences. I've had education, high school, university, college, continuing ed, all of these things. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about frameworks and learning. And I heard you, and we'll get into this after, I assume. I heard you telling our other instructor that was leaving as you were coming, like, learning styles are bullshit.
Oh, so, horse crap.
Okay. So when you're talking
I'm going to follow you, horse.
Yes, follow me. When we're talking about the whole like synchronous and the engagement versus the asynchronous, and we've now established that everybody actually benefits from the asynchronous resources.
That's where
right?
most of the
that's
labor
where
is.
Where the learning happens. And then, it started out with Mark saying that he feels he would learn differently now, where he could be more engaged in
that's not style.
Okay, it's not style. I know. Don't worry. You follow me.
I've learned how to learn.
Okay, so this is my question, is take a look at me. I'm older now. I have an education. You don't actually have to look at me. These guys, man, like everybody on Facebook, like, you have no idea what I fucking put up with behind the scenes here with these guys. Anyway.
Well, it's in front of the scenes now.
I wanted to learn how to play bass guitar, Mark will tell you, I don't have a musical fucking bone in my body.
It's math. Is it math?
Now,
Music is
that's
math.
Not the way he
but,
always
but
describes
there's,
it.
But there's a lot of
there's artistry with the math.
Yes. Forget what it is. Let's I'm using music as an example. Yes, yes. I want to understand would I be able to learn differently now than what I described as university? The way Mark is saying he feels like he can learn differently now if there is no previous framework. Like, I've never learned music.
Okay, so the answer to it is unfortunately abstract. This is what the challenge is. So yes and no. No, you wouldn't be able to learn differently because you're a novice.
Okay.
So now you need to know what the target is and that you're making errors.
Okay.
Right.
But thank you. You've now pieced this all together, because that's where I was stuck on this when, you know, we started out, and I was stuck on, like, well, if there is no framework.
Yeah.
So that's what you're talking about, is the really good novices. And then now that the framework exists, now you can, you know, go to a continuing ed class and you're hanging things because you understand where they go and how to piece these things. Okay.
So
now I got you.
Do you know how to hold a bass?
No.
So now you first you need to know that you don't know how to hold the bass. Somebody needs to tell you how to hold the bass. Then you hold it, and then they tell you that's not right. And you're like, okay, what's right? Right? So the fundamentals are not there, and the familiarity isn't there. So the mechanism's going to be described the same at all points. You need to be able to identify that you've made an error and then correct. If you don't have the information to correct with, you need to get that information.
Right.
But so it's like the details will change and how it's happening, but the mechanism is always the same.
So are my children who are learning piano, are they learning when they're sitting next to their piano instructors? Or is the learning happening more so when they come home with the pieces they've learned and they're practicing on their own?
Both.
Both.
So the place where they're more likely to screw up and learn poorly and do it wrong is when there's no feedback.
Right.
Right. But if they're aware enough, if they have the fundamental exposure, the familiarity to know what the note is supposed to sound like, there's the feedback. Okay. The target is the sound.
Gotcha.
The target is the intended melody, right? So once they know what that is, once they know what that's supposed to sound like, they can self-correct, right? Because you've seen them. They probably do this, the bing, 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 bah, and then it's like bing, 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 bing. Then they get it right because they know they made the mistake, right? So the correction is better done synchronously.
Right.
Right. So this is where, when you're setting up education now, that we happen to have the tools that we have, the ability to be asynchronous has improved heavily, because now we can have a multisensory experience, right? Multisensory being audio, visual, right? Now we don't have smell-o-vision yet, but we might be working on it.
Let's see what Elon Musk and Zuckerberg come up with.
Elon and Zuck are not working on that. But do you remember hearing something about the TV you could taste?
No.
I heard something about that. Somebody was working on that, but yeah.
It's my, like my buddy already does. he's got synesthesia.
Yeah.
He's already tasting TV.
Yeah.
He's tasting sounds. He tastes pain. Yep. It's interesting.
Yep. Well, it's his description and then your interpretation of it, right? Like the best you can do is get close to what the heck is going on.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to teach, let's just say in the case of myself or in the case of a massage therapy school, if you're trying to teach hands-on skills and you're trying to run a budget, you are much better to pre-record the method and give it to students right away. And then when they're showing up on day one, tell them, I want you to have watched this video.
So on day one, they can just do it?
So then you say, show me that what happened in that video. I want you to do it. Right? So you get the teaching out of the synchronous environment. You get the teaching, the fundamental teaching and the familiarity into the asynchronous environment, so that the expert does a better job and spends more time diagnosing and fixing the error. Your money as an institution is better spent on diagnosing and fixing the error. The feedback, the error identification, is better done by the expert than the student.
You know, there's a bunch of teachers saying people aren't going to do the asynchronous work. They're going to show up unprepared.
Yeah, of course they will. Some will, some won't. And then guess what? Guess what you've just diagnosed? that they didn't do the work before. So you're like, okay.
You are the non-diligent students. Yeah. So, and
yeah. So you're going to have to spend more time with them. But that's because they're paying you.
Mm.
Right? So yes, there's going to be people who take it differently. And some of them will continue to perform appropriately. And some of them will wash out. That will happen. That's life. Mm-hmm. And that's different people. So, you know, just to talk about that, when you look at large university courses with varying instructors, you never see the instructors on the test data. You see smart students do good on tests.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you see, right? So when you start to notice that, the only time you will see a teacher, and you have both seen this, right? Because that's one of the, it was Anne, correct?
Anne, yes.
Anne, okay, sweet. I didn't screw up again. I continue to not screw up. She was noticing something within the student population at the student clinical level that she was trying to do something about. She said, these people are going to fail their licensing exam.
Yeah, what she was noticing was just, yeah, complete mismatch. Like they're supposed to be at a certain level mm-hmm. in their education. They're in clinic, and there was fundamental pieces of education that they didn't have.
And then she made the prediction that they were going to have a problem on the licensing exam, and they did. She tried to do something about it. She says, I know the information that they don't have, mm-hmm. and I can show it to them. But because of the tension between administration and educator, there was a challenge. Now, this is legal and this is on paper. Like, this is a legit tension. This is a legit challenge. She was showing good teaching behavior. She was also showing the appropriate use of synchronous time. Identify the error and provide the correction,
mm-hmm.
right? So do you see how this framework starts to do something?
Yep.
Right? And as educators, you've done this. But you didn't necessarily know beforehand that this could be a way to do it,
mm-hmm.
right? So if I was to suggest anything to anybody, as long as electricity and the internet continue to exist, make a gigantic video library that you give to people beforehand. Mm-hmm. Let them watch it as much or as little or as frequently as they want. Then they show up. Then you ask them to do it. You will still do some synchronous teaching
mm-hmm.
to the group, because when you notice the error that the group is making, teach the group about that error.
Right.
Right? And then teach the individual about the error that they're making.
I wish I knew what they do in teachers' college. I wish I knew, because I can't. I wish I can speak to. Yeah, this is kind of what they. This is kind of mm-hmm. what they teach in teachers' college. Or this is not what they do. I wish I knew.
I don't really know. I've got a number of friends who have gone to teachers' college, and maybe it was because it was the more tedious or difficult of the tasks, or maybe it's just when I spoke to each of them happened to be at the same part of the program. But I feel like I heard a lot about curriculum planning and lesson mm-hmm. planning versus actually delivering material.
So
it was a lot of planning.
This is where. I had a long time Mac professor say that I was very didactic, which basically means I like to explain stuff.
You? No.
But he was also a PBL guy, a problem-based learning guy, and really liked it. So, again, to invoke the Socratic method to ask questions, who's curriculum planning for, the educator or the administrator?
Right.
Now, but here's the deal. I'm going to make an assumption and I'm going to think in the vacuum on your behalf. I'm filling in details that I don't have.
You go ahead.
I'm assuming you immediately thought administrator.
I did, based on what you said earlier.
Yes.
Now I'm wondering if I would have had the same answer yesterday.
Yeah. Well, now this is the other thing. There's a priming effect because of what I'm talking to you about.
Yeah.
I am setting constraints because I'm delivering details to you. I'm sharing details and my perspective. So I'm definitely skewing the conversation. So depending on the educator, the curriculum planning is for them. But it's always, sorry for spiking the mic, it's always for the administrator. Always.
Mm-hmm.
Has to be, because the administrator has to have a way to judge
box.
You. Right? But how many people do you know will use the same lesson plan, or have you think you've experienced use the same goddamn lesson plan for 40 years? And never change it.
I really don't know, but I assume lots of them.
Yeah, like
that,
you run into
happen.
Them. Do you ever remember when you were younger and you'd hear about teachers who have been teaching the same thing for their entire career?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like you're like, oh, I know what Mrs. Jones is going to teach. My dad told me.
Oh boy.
Yeah, like do you remember some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So the planning is kind of an initial stage, but it's definitely more appreciated by the administrator, because the administrator needs to judge you. They need to judge if you're doing your job and if you deserve to continue to have that employment,
mm-hmm.
right? Whereas if you're in a situation where you're the administrator and the educator, well, you're beholden to yourself. You do have to make plans. You have to understand how to do it. But if you have the appropriate semantic network of an expert, and so you have that network of related meaning, you can start to build it. So in my school, I don't attempt to teach anatomy to teach you anatomy. Right? Because you've heard the chronic complaint. It's like, well, they know the anatomy, but they can't put it on the table. Mm. Right? They don't relate. At no point do they match. And then what you do as a practitioner is you go out into the world and now you're like, oh, how do I use this anatomy? You talk about, you will grab your anatomy books, right? From time to time.
I used to.
Yeah. Like you would do that because you're like, I need to put this together. So again, the asynchronous environment is where most of the work happens.
Mm-hmm.
I don't teach anatomy and physiology to teach anatomy and physiology. I give you a module on cervical flexion, cervical extension, cervical side bending, and rotation. Guess what? The cervical flexors, you'll talk about those muscles and I put a related piece of physiology in there. And for the most part, they relate to the appropriate region and the appropriate movement, but sometimes they're a little bit different. Like, where the hell do you put mechanotransduction, right? Like, where do you put that? Where do you put multisensory integration?
Right.
Well, you put it somewhere that, you know, doesn't have a lot of physiology happening. But the point is, I want you to relate anatomy and physiology to movement. Because guess what? As a practitioner, you're dealing with movement. You're assessing movement. You're working with movement. So that's what I want the center of the network to be. I want it to be movement. So cervical flexion has certain muscles and nerves and blood vessels. Cervical extension has certain muscles and nerves and blood vessels. Some of them cross over. But guess what happens by the time you get to cervical side bending and rotation? What's the flexors and extenders on one side? Right? And it's the blood vessels and nerves. So now you have repetition, you have redundancy, you have familiarity, right? So I'm building this network through repetition and making the movement, the thing that you're actually going to do as a central competency, the central portion of the mechanism, right? Or the central portion of the semantic network is the more appropriate way to say it, right? So if you start to understand how to layer these things, then you can build it more appropriately because you have anatomy teachers teaching anatomy. And then at some places you have the practitioner teaching the anatomy and the physiology, mm-hmm. but they're not good anatomists and physiologists.
Right.
Right. So you have this weird crossover effect. Whereas when you build it to relate, then it will relate better. It's less, the cognitive load is lower. I'm not asking you to make jumps between the anatomy, physiology, and movement. I'm not teaching them to you separately. Right? It's all at the same time.
Was it in one of those episodes in either Anne's or I think it was in Marvin's where I did complain about the disconnectedness?
It was Marvin's.
It was with Marvin's.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. And yeah, as I'm listening to you, that's sort of what I was trying to say, but yeah. I didn't have good looking English that night. And that's what I was talking about. When I would sit with my anatomy instructor who, you know, had a master's in clinical anatomy, that's who was teaching me anatomy. It was not a practitioner.
Yeah.
And so I was learning regional anatomy, like this is this bone, this is the bony landmark, this is what attaches here. So cool. I got that. Mm-hmm. And the way that I was able to learn that really was just through repetition.
Absolutely.
So it was a lot of memorizing. But then when suddenly I'm in, let's say, a remedial exercise class.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, okay, what muscles, you know, we'll stick with the cervical spine. What muscles are cervical spine extensors?
Yeah.
And now I've got to go back to my regional anatomy, mm-hmm. think about the cervical spine muscles mm-hmm. and try to remember versus like doing it all together. Yeah. Like that's all I was saying is I had trouble and that was probably because I didn't spend as much time studying because I was working full time. I had trouble linking these things
framework.
Together. Yeah, maybe. But I mean, I had a degree.
No, you didn't.
I had a degree in kinesiology. How do I not know this already?
No. Didn't have the framework to hang it on.
Okay.
You didn't have the network of related meaning. You didn't have the semantic network. You were taught, you learned, depending on when you were taught and who taught you and the particular fetish they had, you were taught proximal and distal attachments or origin and insertion,
yep.
mm-hmm.
right? One or the other.
It was origin and insertion when I was in school, yep.
But it's supposed to be proximal and distal attachments now, right? Then you learned actions.
Yes.
And you learned innervation.
Yes.
Right? So you have to remember the muscle, then you have to go through your Rolodex and find the damn action.
Right.
And then when the instructor is like, well, you know, like, why don't you know which ones they are? It's like, well, I know the muscles and I know the actions. It's just not working together right now.
And that's what I mean is it was like a Rolodex. I'd have to go through and like really think about it. And I would say that to Mark when I would say like, I could throw any muscle action or movement or any, like I could say to him, you know, let's take a baseball pitch. I could say to him, what, you know, we can watch it in slow motion and he could tell me what muscles are doing what at what time. Sure. And all, and he could do this really fast. And I would always say to him, I need to know how to do that. Mm-hmm. Like that was where I struggled so much in massage school. And it took a long time of being out of school and like me figuring stuff out before I felt confident enough that I could.
You saw your target in him and the manner in which he was behaving.
And it was so annoying.
You knew that you weren't doing it.
I was
so
not
you had
doing
to bridge
it.
You had to bridge the gap.
Yeah.
One of the things I always bring up in all of my classes that have anything to do with any anatomy that's involved, I'm like, I love anatomy textbooks and I hate them all at the same time.
Yeah.
Right? Because anatomy textbooks, the way they teach you anatomy isn't it doesn't match with the way your body moves well. And the way you learn anatomy doesn't work that way, right?
Right. I've heard talking about like something being listed as like a flexor.
Exactly.
Like this is not a flexor.
So like when you're looking at a muscle in an anatomy textbook, they'll isolate this muscle so you can see its attachments. Cool. Mm-hmm. And then you don't think about this muscle working in combination with other muscles because you're just used to seeing it in this isolated state, right? Mm-hmm. And then when anatomy textbooks say like rhymes off the actions of the muscle, well, it's always talking about its concentric contraction, right? So then you have this person that's now learning this anatomy and they can't understand the concept of how my bicep brachii can extend my elbow. What the fuck? The book didn't say that.
It doesn't make any sense.
Well, you know, when it eccentrically contracts, that's what it's going to do, right? Yeah. So I love it, but I hate it all at the same time.
The best example I ever had of this was I had, I can't remember what I was teaching something. It was a continuing ed course, and we were talking about strengthening, and we were talking about latissimus dorsi. And this was really interesting. So I said to somebody, I'm like, okay, well, how would you give somebody a strengthening exercise like a for the latissimus dorsi? And somebody went like, you guys can't see me, but just like extended their shoulder behind them. And I was like,
did they turn it as well?
Maybe.
Yeah,
but it was just
spin the humerus.
It was
well.
Like right. an extension. And I was like,
you should also tell them, you should also tell them to do a pelvic tilt because the sacrum.
But we're missing
a big piece on that.
Right. So I'm watching this and I'm like, why did you do that?
Because they put it together from the actions they were told.
Right. Yeah. And that's
Which
what
is
I mean
intelligence,
is,
but it's not, you're like, that's actually not how it works.
They didn't know they missed the target. So the thing is, when I was in massage school, like I said, I already had a degree in kinesiology. Right. I'd already done personal training. So there was some, I did have somewhat of a framework where I could say like, you know, I would read something, latissimus dorsi, okay, extension, and know, well, there's a piece to that's missing.
Right. So the piece that we're missing is if it's going to extend the GH, it's going to do that primarily from a previously flexed
position. Right.
Do you know what I mean?
And also when you learned anatomy and you were trying to study anatomy, did you do it mostly with things like flashcards?
100%. Flashcards,
so
charts.
You didn't learn embodied anatomy to be
no,
a hippie.
I learned
flashcards.
I learned charts, not even flashcards.
Yes.
Like exactly what you said. Origin, insertion, action, innervation. That's how I learned my anatomy.
That was your repetition, so that's the center of your network. That's
so on an exam, I could say, yep.
Yes.
Check.
That was your repeated skill.
Yeah.
Whereas your repeated skill is you went more embodied. You're like, how do I make this work?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then when you teach about anatomy and you do it as a package.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this movement, this thing, right?
Yeah.
You stumbled across that because you knew that there was a goal. You're like, I want these people to be better at this thing and I want them to understand what's happening at the same time.
I literally only understand clavicles because of Mark. I will like admit that. No, I only understand clavicles because of Mark, because when we learned about it and we're trying to learn like the surfaces and the moving bone and, you know, in all the accessory movements or whatever, I was so fucking lost. I'm not even going to pretend I wasn't. Like, I knew basics. I'm like, shoulder go up, clavicle go up. Like, that's what I knew, Like, I didn't really know. And it wasn't until I was helping Mark with like a joint mobilization course and he was showing the surfaces of clavicle, like looking at it from superior, looking at it from anterior. I'm like, oh, I understand clavicles.
And then you can boil that down a little bit more. Like what I would generally suggest is that if you're looking at the shoulder girdle, the scapula is the smarter place to try to figure stuff out. That because it's a bigger thing, it's more tangible, there's more stuff going on. Then when it's not working anymore, you're like, what the hell else is left? Okay, the clavicle. And in a meaningful sense, in a very meaningful sense, it's very unlikely that you're going to really find a problem at the SC joint. you're probably going to find a problem with the pec, with the muscles on the medial border, so rhomboids, major and minor, if they have minor traps. And then I tend to talk medial border of the scap, lateral border, because it's like I can pinch it and grab it, right? And if there's a problem kind of getting to that 90, right, then I'm like, okay, probably rotator cuff-ish. Right, you know, your rotator cuff orthopedic thumbs up or thumbs down, so full can, empty can. And it's like, it's definitely this muscle. It's like, shut up, leave me alone, right? But then I call the pecs as a unit the anterior border. So I have these things that I can go to real quick, because if you're having a problem with the SE, like, it's less likely that it's the SE joint, more likely it's a challenge with the pec, right? Or it could be something on the back. Right, like it could be that, because you can't get the scapula into the position to allow the SE to move. But if there's a problem with the clavicle, well, I'll talk about the AC, because the AC you can get more of a meaningful glide.
The only way to even understand any of this is actually to learn anatomy in terms of movement. Yeah. And like I said, that was the piece that was really missing. So, you have to really understand functional movement.
Massage therapists are generally, from what I see, at least the people that come to take our courses,
who are looking for help.
Yeah, they're horrible. They're horrible at reading range of motion. They don't know what to do with the range of motion assessment, because they don't put all the pieces together. Yeah. Right. So when I break it down, when we're talking about a range of motion assessment, like, range of motion gives you so much information you don't even recognize, because in massage school, generally you're taught, okay, can you move? Are you willing to move? Are you not?
This
willing
joint
to move?
Moves this many degrees. Is it excessive? Yeah. This plane?
Excessive?
Yeah.
Is there any audible sounds? Is it decrepitous? Yeah. Blah 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 blah. And so when I start talking about it, because I talk about it in a very mechanical way. Mm-hmm. I'm like, listen, I don't know anything about cars, but I know if there's something wrong with my braking system, my mechanic just doesn't suddenly change my brake pads.
No, right? They check.
Right. So what are they going to do? They're going to inspect every part of my braking system. And as a mechanic would do, they'll either repair a faulty part or they'll replace a faulty part. But you don't know any of that until you assess the whole braking system. Yeah. So when you're looking at a range of motion, well, let's look at everything that makes this movement possible.
Yeah.
Right. What muscles are contracting concentrically? What muscles are lengthening? What's the component motion of other joints that are involved, if there are any, which there will be? What are the arthrokinematics that are happening at all these different joints? And then once you understand what these things are supposed to be doing, then this is now meaningful to you. Until you understand what all these things are supposed to be doing during this given range of motion, it doesn't mean jack.
So I appreciate that, because it's appropriately related. What I would suggest is that anything that you do to attempt to interpret anything deeper than the superficial thing you can see, hands-on therapy, external environment of observation, you're outside of them, you're looking at it.
Yep.
You see bending left, bending right. That's what you see. You have no meaningful, accurate ability to know which muscle it is, because there's so much variability between different people and within the same person, right? So I appreciate everything you said. It's based on a normalized concept. Within that normalized concept, you can make a lot of interpretation based on the movements that you find. You get a huge amount of information. I would say stay with the movement. Over time, you can increase your confidence in what it probably is, right? So like when somebody has a problem picking their shoulder up in the sagittal plane. Stupid set. Frontal, coronal. I don't even like saying frontal plane. I like coronal better, but that's just me. But anyway, sagittal plane, and they go and they say pain like this. Mm. I'm going with the bicep tendon. But I don't know what's the bicep tendon. I'm like, based on what you're telling me, I think you might have something going on with that bicep tendon. It seems to make sense, especially when I palpate through there. It's that nice vertical line in that report. And I'm like, hey, this is when you should probably talk to your doctor and get them to look at it. Well, they don't want to look at it. I'm like, yeah, well, tell them somebody told you they think that there's something going on with your bicep tendon. Mm. Right? There's ways to do that. But you can definitely have some increased confidence based on all the information you have. You have to understand the deeper stuff. But if you do it as that movement package, you have a better starting place as opposed to, you know, all the fancy words.
Right.
Right. The fancy words have meaning, because if you're not able to use them, you can't communicate with other people. Right. So the accuracy does matter. And for me to say, back off, to be a little bit less accurate, is kind of weird, because I like accuracy. Mm-hmm. But I understand what you're trying to teach people. So because most professionals are being asked to do these highly detailed interpretations of something that you can't actually do that with in a meaningful way, you get confused people. It's too cognitively demanding. It's the cognitive load is too high. There's too many interacting elements. You're not paying attention to what's right in front of you. If you can't see, like literally visually see, that it bends better to the left than it does to the right, what the hell are you going to work on? Right? So start with, does it move good to the left and the right? If yes, leave alone. If no, then the side that it bends good to, that's the side that doesn't like to lengthen. It'll shorten, it won't lengthen. That's the one I do, right? Simplify the decision-making, make it less complicated. Like, what decision do I have to actually make? I have to make the decision, where does it not move good? What do I do to it, right? And that's the framework. So if you build from that framework, you've got way more. Then we can have the fancy, sexy conversation.
I like the sexy conversation.
What are the fancy, sexy conversations?
Arthrokinematics.
Arthrokinematics is sexy. Okay.
That's
sexy.
Greek.
It's very sexy.
Yeah,
very
but
sexy.
It's because you sound so smart. Even though you're saying something like very obvious and simple, if you know the Greek and the Latin, it's just like,
big words. Do you like when folks use big words?
Yeah.
Me?
Yeah. If they're appropriate. Mm. And that's hilarious coming from me because I use big words. Right? It's like, Sam, why are you so judgy of people who do what you do? I'm like, because they're not doing it right.
I don't find that you use obnoxiously big words for no reason when there is a more commonly used way to say what you're saying. So you're not incredibly annoying about it. And actually earlier today you said, I wish I could remember, we can go back and listen, but earlier today you said a word and then you literally defined the word and I went in my mind very quietly, thank you.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't 100% sure what you meant. So,
which is what a good speaker does, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. I was like, I am a little embarrassed to admit I didn't know what that meant, but he defined it. So we're okay.
Which is what a good speaker does.
Well, so here's the deal. Never assume what people know.
Thank you.
Yes.
And so that's where it seems like you can be really wordy and have these long explanations. It's like, well, yeah, because you don't know it. And I don't want to roll on with the conversation like you do. Then I'm just being a dick.
Exactly. I know dudes and ladies that do those dick moves to
Trailer Park Boys.
To display a certain level of intelligence. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you actually sound dumber because you don't recognize that the receiver of the information is not getting it.
Yeah.
So are you actually smart in this moment in giving this information the way you're delivering it? Or are you stupid in this moment because it is not going anywhere?
Yeah.
I definitely view it as, it's to me, it's comparable to, you know, those people who tell you stories and they tell you stories about people you don't know, but they tell you these stories as if you do know these people.
Yeah. Yes.
Like they just start throwing out names.
Yeah. Like, 80s moms who just came back from the office.
There you go. I check out of that conversation just the same as I check out when somebody starts using an enormous amount of jargon that I can't follow what they're saying. And not be, and most of the time it's not even that I don't understand the words. I'm like, this combination of words was a really unnecessary and strange way to get this point across. I've checked out. All I'm thinking about is, why did you say it like that?
Which makes you stupid.
Yeah, so I'm going to attempt to do two things.
Doesn't make you smart, it makes you dumb.
I'm going to attempt to do things and hopefully I remember to do it right. Talking about the ability to identify that the receiver is not taking the word appropriately.
Yes.
That is appropriate use of synchronous time. Identify the problem and provide the correction. Mm-hmm. So when somebody looks like, what just happened? So the way that I would say it is when I was initially, the initial time at which I taught osteopathic manual therapy, I would say something that I thought was really neutral. I'd look out at the room and I would see adults look at me like I shot their dog. I'm like, whoa, that didn't work. I thought I said something clear. That did not work. I have to fix this.
Yes.
So it made me learn how to fix it on the fly and try to get the feedback. Did I hit the target? So fundamental learning mechanism. I'm the teacher. I'm learning how to teach because I'm like, I have a target and it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So again, the framework starts to come together. Then as far, oh God damn it. What was the other one? It was good, man.
You warned us.
The jargon. No, I can't do the second thing because I forgot it. But basically, the appropriate use of the synchronous time is to identify what's working, what's not working, and use your expertise to do something about that. So yeah, the thing that I don't like saying good speakers, but the thing that the speaker who's actually trying to hit their target is going to do is going to make sure that you know what's going on. They're going to take mm-hmm. the time to provide the feedback and the information to make sure that you know.
Why don't you like and saying this, good speakers?
You're an effective speaker.
Yeah.
Or you're this is why I don't like to plan.
Yeah.
I like to be able to free flow and change it up whenever I recognize, because I'm constantly giving out information, assessing the scenario. Am I hitting the mark here? Yeah. Do I need to make corrections? Yeah, and then if I've got too many things planned going on, then I find my ability to assess in those moments, it doesn't go very well.
Yeah, and the plan can actually really just hinder what you're trying to do and really just get in your way. And it can make, I mean, for me, it makes me very flustered. So for example, I taught a cupping class, I don't know, a week or so ago to a group of therapists that had all been in this profession more than 20 years. Mark taught a cupping class a few days later to a group of therapists who are like 1 to 2 years into practice. Mm-hmm. There was one guy who had 21 years. But so I taught to all these therapists that have years and years of experience, and he taught to a group of newbies. We can't possibly it was the same course, it was the same PowerPoints. We can't possibly deliver that the same way.
Yep.
I mean, it was two different teachers.
I never
but
teach a course.
He would have done both of them completely different.
So what I'll say is, again, to talk about framework, your framework is the same outcome goal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Your details are different.
Yep.
That outcome goal dictates the framework. Mm-hmm. The details are dictated by the needs of who's in front of you. Right. So it's the ability to be responsive. And this is the tension between the administrator and the educator. The educator's got the outcome goal. The administrator's got the piece of paper that makes them happy and, you know, I don't know, for some reason allows them to get a big salary for non-productive work.
Can you be a good public speaker and be a shitty educator?
This is where the goal depends, right? Like, so if you talk about engagement and, you know, getting a rise out of the crowd, well, professional wrestlers, great public speakers, the best public speakers, because all they're looking for is the pop. Pro wrestling promos are phenomenal.
I think I just posted a clip about this.
Ric Flair, baby.
Yeah. I was listening to create a clip about our podcast. We were talking about actors and we were talking about wrestlers.
And we had Tylene here today, who's like the president of like a wrestling fan club. I just made that up, but like really, actually.
Yeah. So, jet flying, limousine riding, wheeling dealing, diamond like wheeling dealing, kiss stealing, son of a gun, woo! Can't keep these alligators down, right? Like I missed some, but the ability to cut that promo, you're looking for the pop.
Yeah.
That's why you have the heels and the baby faces. So the bad guys are the heels, the baby faces are the good guys. Yep. It doesn't matter to them; they're just looking for the pop, right? So you can be a very effective public speaker. Comedians, very effective public speakers,
absolutely,
the best. So pro wrestlers and comedians, I would say they're the best public speakers as a group, not necessarily as individuals because there's crappy pro wrestlers and crappy comedians, but the ability to connect with the crowd and get responses. So your target is the response. You learn how to do that. But as far as educational ability, maybe not the best. Hmm. They may not be the best educators, but man, they will engage a crowd.
That was, I don't know, some sort of light bulb moment for me. The target is the response when it comes to a speaker.
Right.
Yes.
But yeah, an educator.
Well, so here's the deal.
You have to be really much more in tune with, am I hitting the target, than a comedian or a really good public speaker.
So if you had an educator that was just a really good public speaker and you're like, oh, fuck. Have you had an educator that was only just a fabulous public speaker?
So 100%.
Did the students respond well to them? Did they did they have charisma?
100%.
And then nobody could do what they were asked.
100%. Yeah.
So here's the deal. Target and response are fantastic category words, right? So the target is the outcome goal.
Yep.
Right? The response, like the target is the response, the medium is the message, right? There's a way in which you could use that. So the response, So the target could be the response itself. The response could be, the detail of the response could be laughter. It could be engagement. It could be applause, right? For an educator, the target is the response, but the response is the performance.
Right. So that's what I mean is, if you're looking at, let's say, a non-hands-on type of learning, like let's say you're in a lecture, it takes somebody who... I mean, I assume it takes somebody who's really in tune with the room, like you were talking about, you know, speaking to a bunch of people and realizing, oh, I did not hit that target. Okay.
When do you think a university lecturer would figure out if they hit the target or not?
Well, in a room of 800 people, when, can they?
What time? What's the... What's
only
the,
exams.
And there's, and, a like you said, and there's a time delay.
Right.
So they never
know. Never know. And like you said, the exams, they feel like, oh, pat me on the back. Look at how great my class did. Yeah. Or we were just all fucking brown nosers and went home and made sure that we studied our asses
or
off.
We just
and
all bought the exams from last semester.
Yeah. But that's still the
you can do
resource.
That,
and so it still fits the framework.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the delay in feedback, the feedback for the lecturer is the exam.
Yep.
But there's the it's really easy to miss with the time delay that it wasn't you.
It wasn't you.
Yeah. Now the as far as say you see how I'm interacting with the conversation and I keep coming back to the same framework and mm-hmm. hanging different details on it. So if you want to talk about the concept of transfer in education or the ability to learn something in one setting and apply that thing in a different setting, your classic paradigm is the direct application. So it's like, I teach you this skill here, I want you to do it over here. There is near transfer, which is exceptionally similar or slightly dissimilar circumstances. I teach it to you in one room, and then I make you do it in a different room with a different table. The table height's a little different, and the color of the room's different, right? The far transfer is really much more about expertise, right? So the only people you really see far transfer in is experts, and really what you're seeing is expertise. You're far less seeing the ability, like the unique skill of transferring farther. Because far transfer is really defined by what would be called deep features. The deep features are the things you can't see or touch but are always there. Right? So the framework and the semantic network or network of related meaning or the scaffolding are the things that are always there but you can't see or touch. So in the conversation, this is behavior I've had to learn because I now explicitly know it. I keep relating everything we're doing back to the same frameworks. I keep pulling it back. So if you want to improve far transfer in novices to a given subject, what you want to do is explicitly tell them what that intangible feature is that's the same no matter what, and then you want to give them multiple examples of it. Right? So explicitly give them multiple examples of it. So if I talk to you about the barrier concept, I want to tell you what the direct barrier and the indirect barrier are, and then I want to show it to you multiple ways. And then I want to show you how in patient seated, this is how you engage the direct barrier in the cervical column. In patient supine, this is how you do it. In patient prone, this is how you do it. In side lying, well, don't do it because it's stupid to treat a naked side lying. It's not nice. Because you're either standing behind the person or you pick their head up in front of them, and basically, whether you're a male or a female, their face is in your boobs. Right? Like, so it's just dumb. But to show it to you, to make sure that you know those details and have those multiple examples of the exact same thing as often as possible. I tell you that there's a framework, that there's this intangible thing. I show it to you and show it to you and show it to you so that I improve your opportunity to have familiarity with it and then utilize it for decision making when you're practicing. So what I'm attempting to do is generate a really good novice. But what I'm hoping to do is utilize the best behavior for information delivery that would give me the best opportunity to make them as close to an expert with as many opportunities for errors that they know exist, that they know they missed, mm-hmm. and then make sure they correct it appropriately based on the framework. So the framework is omnipresent. The errors are detectable, and they make as many mistakes as early as possible so that I prune most of them and make them understand what the dangers of expertise is. The danger of expertise is that you learn what not to do and you forget that it exists. So then when you're assessing somebody or you're doing something, you go to your go-to moves and you forget that you have other moves that you can create. So I'm actually trying to create practitioners who can create whatever they need whenever they need it.
How calculated is this for you, or how natural is it for you?
So it was learned initially mm-hmm. through knowing that I had a target, knowing that I missed it, and trying to fix it. So I did the good behavior first. I went to get my master's. I learned that that was good behavior. So I didn't know that I had good teaching behavior
right.
until I knew more details. Then when I learned about how you create a scaffold, right? So scaffold is a term you'll hear more often in educational administrative settings
right.
and communication about education. But the semantic network is the cognitive psychology term. I like semantic network better because it's a network of related meaning, and I can say, well, here's these concepts that are omnipresent.
Yep.
There you go. And I can work on that. So initially, it was less explicitly calculated,
right,
more calculated by need.
Gotcha.
Then I learned more details. Now it's all completely calculated, right? So it's on purpose, and I do take great pleasure in saying, see, I did it again. I did the thing I said I was doing again.
So you listened to Anne's experience.
I listened to most of it. I didn't listen to the entire thing.
Okay.
But I think, I hope I got the gist, you because you're about to give me something, and you, I hope I don't screw up.
No, I'm now just tying this all back together. You listened to Anne's experience. Mm-hmm. You listened to, you know, Marvin, mm-hmm, who was giving us a little bit more insight as to how things work, talking about the administration and the way the programs are designed, and all of these things. Is there anything that you feel like, whether it's administration, program design, instructors, is there anything we could all do just better? Like, I mean, I understand now what you're talking about with the framework, but I mean, from a program design perspective, or from the paper in the background, the administrative standpoint, is there something that massage therapy education or any kind of education could do a little bit better, where we're actually using these concepts and understanding the best use of instructional time?
So the best meta framework I could say is identify the outcome goal. So there's a term in education settings called constructive alignment. So you know how you're always asked to write learning objectives?
Yes.
Learning objectives are outcome goals.
Right.
Right. And then you have to find a way to make it measurable. It's like, oh, God damn it. It's like, these are such buzzwords, but the term is constructive alignment. So you have the outcome goal and you build towards the outcome goal. So all of your steps, especially when you write them out on paper, should look like they're taking you towards your outcome goal. Right. It's like, yeah, but that's not actually how it functions. So just make sure that you have your outcome goal and that your outcome goal is actually meaningful to the performance that the person is going to have to apply. So in hands-on therapeutics, the outcome goal is alteration in movement based on assessment. The alteration in movement often in massage therapy is yield to pressure for soft tissues. You squish the tissue and it either squishes as expected or like its neighbor, or it doesn't. Right? Usually, at least in Ontario and at least in Canada, the momentum of the public is to say, I'm not going to let you do a proper assessment on me. Just, I want to lay down on the table and push where I tell you I want it pushed, right? That's what happens, unfortunately, because massage therapists are trained to do proper assessments, and some massage therapists will do a really good job. The patient comes in and you walk into the room and you say, we're going to do an assessment. Like, you can do that, and you can generate your practice that way. But the meta framework, or the primary outcome goal, is change motion characteristic based on the assessment method that I use. So if you know that that's what it is, make that your greater good, make that your target. You can work backwards from there. What I would say is that most people will, upon hearing this, if they decide to onboard that concept, they will use the words that they're doing that, but they don't necessarily know how to build the ability to see it, to observe and to measure. What I would say is, if you like education and you like testing protocols, Do not use a procedural checklist. Did they do step 1, 2, 3? That's the novice. The novice test is a checklist.
Right.
Answer these questions in this order. Tell me these steps in this order. Show me these steps in this order, and then I know you're safe. Well, if the CMTO has issues with safety and complaints, is it doing the proper job? Now, they would tell you that they would give you percentages, or any regulatory college would give you the percentages or hours, or however they want to measure it, of, you know, delivered service with no complaint. Mm-hmm. And then the opposite is the delivered service with complaint. Like, right. They would have a way to measure this. And I don't know what way anyone does it, but they would say, well, it's only this percentage of practitioners, right? So they're gonna have a way to normalize that. It's like, yeah, but... I mean, so what I will say is, at least within the medical profession, higher scores on licensing exam predicts less likelihood of lawsuit.
Right.
Right. But that's because they're experts. They're doing their job better. Right. So what I would say, especially if you're looking at competencies, because if I'm not mistaken, CMTO does talk about competencies. They want competency-based frameworks, right?
Yep.
Competency-based education. If you're looking for competency, do not use procedural checklists. Use global rating scales. Global rating scales, you know, those things where you get surveys where it's, you know, strongly disagree, disagree,
yes,
neutral, right? That's called a Likert scale. You're anchoring on different types of things. You want to anchor on the qualities and the outcome characteristics that you're looking for in a performance.
Right.
And then you use, the more numbers you have, the more sensitive the scale is. But 1 to 5 is often going to be good enough, and you have to have your anchors, right? So what I've done is I've generated one that's 1 to 5. One is like, well, this is trash. And these are the terms that would you can anchor on that it's trash. 3 is acceptable. 5 is like, man, you're good.
Right.
Right. You don't expect people to do well on that test when they start. If they do good, that's fine. You don't want to see them do great.
Right.
You want to see them do okay and do better over time. And then at a certain point, you want to see them consistently look good on that test. A global rating scale has a higher ability to differentiate between a novice and an expert because the expert is the outcome giver. The novice is the step follower.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the knowing what your outcome goal in that public healthcare setting is, and because you know how you'll hear that saying, people perform for the test, or like they essentially learn to pass the test.
Yep.
Well, make the test about the outcome goal in that public setting, right? Know what that is. Know what that looks like. Build the construct, or like a construct is something that is definably it and not something else. So the ability to have separate construct is, these things define what thing A is, and thing B is exceptionally similar, but there is these things that make sure you know it's, this is thing A and this is thing B, right? So they're separate, right? So in the example that I used before, education delivery, the required information for the performance is one construct. The way that you deliver it and treat somebody is a separate construct. Like how you treat somebody and the delivery of the appropriate information happen at the same time, but they're different things,
right?
So the know what that performance is and shoot for that performance. Teach to the test. The test is in-office behavior. So find a way to define in-office behavior that's appropriate and repeatable. And you'll have psychometricians and test makers that love this, and they'll do their job, but you got to remember that they're not practitioners. They're psychometricians, so they're really good at psychometrics, which is fine. They're going to make a good test, but you want some degree of knowing what that looks like. So, you know, let's just say you really like science and you want to do some kind of study. Well, you got to go watch a bunch of people in office, see how they behave, record that. Then you have to normalize that data. Okay, this is good behavior. This is bad behavior. How would I tell the difference? Then you make your test and then you teach to that test, right? So what is probably happening for the most part that is essentially the impetus for me to come in, the comment that I made that you're trying to make a really good novice. Now, what I define a really good novice as versus what regulatory bodies would might be different, and that's okay. You know, there's differences of opinion all the time. But the...
I'm going to guess it's not going to be different, but go ahead.
What I think a good novice is? No, it'd be different.
What's what you
got to
say?
My novice would be better. Because my novice isn't necessarily going to be as tainted by administrative task, right? But you are going to teach to that test, right? So you, man, I lost it. I was doing
you were
so
saying
good.
That, you know,
thank you so much.
Back
already.
To the reason why you came in, your definition of a really good novice and what you meant by that comment.
Yeah. So the really good novice is somebody who is going to be able to identify what the problem is and provide an outcome. Whereas in most regulated circumstances, the really good novice is the one that has satisfied the nerves of the regulator who is trying to protect the public from the practitioner.
Right.
Right. So they're going to set forth hurdles that they think are meaningful to that. And they're going to have some form of data to back that up and call it valid. And it probably is. But what you tend to see, unfortunately, across regulated professions is that you still get the sociopath. They're always scared about the sociopath, and they should be, but you can't identify them because they're really good at being, you know, they're really good at hiding.
That's why they're sociopaths.
Yeah. Yeah, right? So what you want to do is teach to the performance, right? And then as a market-based activity, you can predict that the person who's going to stick in the profession is the person who's good at the performance, good at the outcome, that people will continue to see based on that. One of the really interesting thing in hands-on professions, people who are really good at getting the outcome are often not going to be as good at the business, because they're actually generating the outcome, which is improving the complaint of the patient. My outcome is, does it move better? Their outcome is, does it feel the way I want it to feel?
Right.
Or does it feel different than it currently does? So that actually limits your return business, right? You were noting that you're more likely to try to say, like, I'm going to change this. You're more likely to cultivate that longer term, we're going to deal with this.
Yeah, I want
to
be friends with everyone. I'm kidding.
Yeah, well, it's not that, but you practice in a different fashion. Your outcome goal and her outcome goal happen to be different time scale.
Yeah.
Right? But you would see that, let's just say we were to, you know, plot it out over time, you're probably going to have more return people more consistently. So your schedule would probably look fuller more often, where your schedule, should you be in practice, would probably have ebbs and flows, mm-hmm. right? Whereas when you're practicing, you're just rammed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So
does massage school have to be longer? Is that what you're saying?
No.
You sure?
I just don't necessarily know how long it is, and I don't necessarily know exactly what the impetus for a particular hour count, because hour count is unfortunately not the way to get to the outcome goal.
To get to the point that you're describing, mm-hmm. we have to first build all of this foundational knowledge, which is then what you're evaluated on, mm-hmm. and then you're thrown into the field. So for us to get to the point that you're describing, it takes time.
Yeah, but it's... You know, it's a fixed outcome variable time, because people will need more time. And that's where that asynchronous resource actually becomes really helpful.
I was going to say, the efficiency could improve that it may not need more time.
Well, it's not that it doesn't need more time. It needs the time that it needs. But the learner is going to take care of that. The way that the learner will know that they didn't take care of that is they failed the test.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if your test is for constant feedback to tell them what their errors are, they can fix the errors faster.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know what they are. So you can build in these efficiencies with good educational practice. And, you know, you do need to schedule things, right? So, and people in positions of granting authority like time-based things, they are learning more about competency-based and outcome goal-based. But to inculcate the fundamental knowledge to become a massage therapist, more likely is, you know, can you make the change? Can you find the problem? Can you make the change? Well, I mean, I would say that you can probably get people there pretty fast. It's how sexy do you want their talking to be, right? And then that's where you offload the sexy talking things, the anatomy and the physiology and the biomechanics, into the asynchronous realm. Because you could be much more efficient with your in-person time and your in-class time and paying for your overhead as an institution if you're focusing on identifying the errors in physical practice and fixing them. And assessing for the outcome goal, the in-office experience. And most people are going to say, like, well, then we need to put them in the cubicle with a random anonymous patient. And I'm like, not necessarily. You need to know what it is.
No, you need to, I mean, I keep going back to, you were talking about checklist. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of learning that I've done over my entire career as a student has been checklist.
Yes.
I do fabulous on exams because I can do a checklist versus like reverse engineering a problem. Mm-hmm. This is what's going on and actually looking at it from the standpoint of, like, not just knowing this is the origin, this is the insertion, mm-hmm. this is the action, this is the innervation, looking at movements, what could possibly be involved, what could I see? Like, I see where you're looking at, like, let's look at what outcome we want from this, look at that goal versus, did you do active range of motion? Did you do passive? Because do people know how, Mark made the point earlier, people don't even know what they're reading when they're looking at these things. Yep. So understanding how to take a person or a patient or a situation or whatever, and what do we want to do with this?
Yep.
And then let's work backwards. Yep. And like you said, being able to quickly identify those errors, then I would have learned something versus I did my active range of motion, I did my passive range of motion, I did my active resistance range of motion, I did my special tests.
You passed your good novice test. You excelled at your good novice tests, and the regulator said that's awesome because that's what they asked you to do.
Yeah.
They taught to the test.
Right.
And you perform to the test. If the test is, I need to be able to find the problem in anyone at any time, and I need to find a way to make it effective and efficient, which means I'm definitely going to miss some stuff. But when my tests don't make me find the thing that I need to find, well, then I know what I didn't do and I can bring that in, right? So there's a way to engineer this all that is low cognitive load, good educational behavior, and teaching to the target, which is when I'm not looking at the person, are they going to help the person that I've never met and they've never met? Right. And that's what I am building and refining. So obviously right now I'm pretty damn sure I built it right, but I mean, I have to make changes all the time. So, but that's because I know what my target is. My target is the performance.
That works well with the level of learner that is coming to you.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
Right. What I would say is that because it's based on fundamental educational principles, it would work appropriately with any level. Right. Because I think what you're noting is, say, the level of information that a complete novice would need to onboard would seem higher because the familiarity is lower.
Yes.
And that's what the asynchronous environment's for.
Right.
Right. That's why you utilize it for the extreme power that it has. Because how did you get there? You used your asynchronous environment. You did not learn everything in that lecture hall.
So starting, going all the way back to the beginning then, Mark, what do you think has changed? Why do you think that you could utilize your synchronous time more effectively now than in university?
It starts with familiarity. Yeah, like you're so familiar with all of it. You've taught it. You've dissected it. You've reverse engineered it. You flipped it in all directions. Therefore, my guess is when somebody's demonstrating something,
went very Missy Elliott on us.
You barely even need to look at it.
I'm also thinking, like, if I'm learning something I've never learned before.
Well, you're like, in hands-on therapy, you're not.
But that's why I brought up the example of music. So I was trying to look at is there a framework that already exists for something I've never learned before? Is just learning enough to have built a framework? You know what I mean? Is just learning anything enough to have built a framework for me to better learn?
So
that's what I would have said. That's why I can
That's what I was trying to figure out from you before when I brought up the bass guitar.
So sort of yes, but more no. Because if you don't know how to transfer in new details, right? Like I'm a better learner. It's like, no, you're a better expert, right? So your ability to abstract does improve. So it's like you accidentally get better at learning something new.
Yeah.
But if it's a little bit too hard and outside of your reach, then you get pissed off and quit. If it's too easy, you get pissed off and quit, right? So that's the zone of proximal development. So it has to be just hard enough that it's interesting and maintains your interest. But if you're completely novice to it, the mechanism, the fundamental mechanism is the same, to know the error and then correcting for the error. But when you know more about the subject, it takes way less effort because you already have a framework for that information. Whereas if it's a completely novel thing, you don't have the framework for that information. You may be better at building frameworks, so it may look faster, right? But it's not that you necessarily... It's not that it's going to work that way because you may not be able to import the ability to build a framework to these details.
I get what you're saying. But you can, in fact, become at least to people watching you, you can become a better learner.
Yeah. And some people are good learners. Like they've developed a way internal to them that they probably couldn't describe exceptionally well that they do onboard and build that.
I can't describe it. At all.
Yeah, oh my goodness.
Because you've asked me to and I can't. I'm like,
At least once a week too, Mark will come out with the most random fact. Mm-hmm. Like something very interesting. Like we'll be watching something and he'll say, hey, this guy in 1967 said this, whatever. And then this happened. And like he'll just spew out something. Mm-hmm. And then he'll look at me and say, how did I know that? I'm like, I don't fucking know.
Yeah. So you have a large semantic network, a network of things that cross over, and you're able to import and move around.
And that's the thing is now that certain, like, whether it's a visual cue or auditory cue, like you'll hear something and you'll remember this guy in 1967. Mm-hmm. So now you as an adult and you've gone through all of your education and whatever, you say you're a better learner now. It's also like what Sam is saying, there is some sort of framework there. If it's something completely new, you just have an ability to actually make sense of things easier and quicker than you did when you were 19.
And one of the ways that's happening is because you've crossed so many things over that when something's new, you're probably, as a description, this isn't necessarily how it works, but you compare it to a bunch of things, you find the thing that it's similar to, and now you're making those connections.
Where nothing's actually ever really new.
The detail is the new thing, but there's so much to hang it on and connect it to.
Yeah.
So let's just say, as information delivery, and I've said this for a very long time, this was before I knew about this, it's when I was doing it based on knowing what my outcome goal was and then missing it and correcting, is I'm like, listen, I make bad jokes on purpose, like completely on purpose, because there's a piece of information I want you to know, right? So I need you to be able to get there. I'm going to make the bad joke. So if you can't remember the piece of information, maybe you remember the bad joke, and I'm really hoping you judge me for it, because you're taking a test and you're like, you're trying to figure it out. And then all of a sudden, for some strange reason, you're annoyed. And then you remember when I annoyed you with the bad joke. Mm-hmm. So you judge me and you're like, there it is, right? So it's things that happen at similar times connect because they happened at similar times. So you have a piece of information and a feeling. Well, if the feeling gets triggered, now you can get to the piece of information, right? So it's stimulus pairing.
There we go, teachers who are listening, annoy your students.
Well,
if you're, I'm just kidding.
Not that way. Like, be good.
Piss
with
them
it.
Off.
Be higher skilled at being able to inject variations in what's going on. Humor is a way to do it, but remember, your humor is not everybody's humor. You have to get good at humor. Like, I really like telling jokes. It's like, yeah, but they're all bad and stupid, and I'm not paying attention to the information because I'm just too judgmental of you, right? So what I would say is that educators get really intent on delivering the details of the information, and they love the details. They don't know that the student can't onboard them as too much information, cognitive load's high, and then they're like, okay, now you tell them give jokes. Now they get really serious about the details of the joke, and it just gets weird and uncomfortable. And then some people are such performers, they're such TED talkers, that they're, you know, they get, I call it the, this is not necessarily the most appropriate, but our prime minister, you know how when he's giving speeches that have been pre-written, he's often breathless. So my joke is, because another person in the public sphere happens to speak very breathless when trying to get a reaction, and it's Greta Thunberg, I say Justin Trudeau went to the Greta Thunberg School of Oration, because they get, so there's that performative thing that's a style. You onboard somebody else's style. It's a completely normal thing.
Yep.
So as much as I might be judgmental of it, it's not weird. It's completely normal. But people get this rhythm and they get TED talky, and they're like, and they get, you know, they have the pauses and the, did you know? Right? It's like, oh, God damn it. Be you, man. To cultivate you, become a more interesting person, and you'll get better at this, right? Like, actually become a more interesting person, get more interesting information. Now, obviously, people are going to be different in this, and they're going to be convinced that they're doing it real good, right? So all these things I'm saying, they're foundational, fundamental, and usable, but the clumsy novice is going to do a bad job. So if somebody's doing a bad job, but they're trying to do it, well, I'm not going to make fun of them. I'm going to help them, right? And I mean, my aim is to help. Like, I like sharing information.
What do you think of people that are super calculated?
I need more information.
Yeah, because I'm super calculated. But, like, it's not malicious.
Right. But I'm curious as to your overall impression of an individual when you recognize that everything is calculated.
So, when you say calculated, is it fair to say more pre-planned and they don't deviate?
Well thought out.
Yeah.
With an outcome in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I execute on that and I don't stray. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's the not straying. It's sticking to the script.
Are we talking strictly in an educational setting, or are we talking in
I'm talking
setting.
In general. Because you're interesting. Because you're really calculated.
Yeah.
But then there's the other side of Sam that's...
It's all over the
place. That's the, you can do Beavis and Butthead, and then in 2 seconds later be super calculated, overly intelligent.
Because you said that, do you remember the movie? And he's like, it's 1990, whatever. I'm sure we can find other ways to entertain us. And they're like, he said anus.
Exactly.
Right?
I need TV from my bunghole.
Cornholio.
So I'm curious as to what do you think of the overall calculated individual? Everything appears to be really calculated.
You know, I've been trying to really think of a person other than Sam, because he just said I'm really calculated. I'm trying to think of a person.
Is part of what he does. It's
right,
not,
so
it's not his 100%.
I'm trying to think of a person that I know that
I can help
is super calculated. You
think
can
of
help.
A politician.
Well, I don't know them.
Think about what you see of politicians as they present in a broad a broadcast space, whether it's a public speech, a public speech is a broadcast, or something on TV or something on the radio. Like, what's that feel like to
you?
Well,
I mean, as a podcaster, I can say, you know, Mark asked me, do you plan things? I mean, I'm the least calculated person on the face of the earth. I don't plan anything. I have constant conversations going on in my head, though, which I think helps and is a form of planning because
it is.
It's
rehearsal.
In my mind, I might think of something and I purposely store that and hold on to it because I'm like, this is an interesting fact and I might use this later, or this relates to,
you're,
you know,
building your semantic network.
I am building my semantic network. But is it calculated? No. When we first started podcasting, part of our growth is when we realized that everything is more interesting and we have more genuine and real authentic conversations when we just come in and we get to know the person behind the mic in real time. Yep. And that's when we started to really hit our stride and do well as podcasters. Mm-hmm. When I hear other podcasters, or you were talking about broadcasts, where it's very clear that these people have, you know, they've sent their info sheets to each other. They've pre-planned questions. Mm-hmm. The podcaster has done research on the topic beforehand. Yep. So they're asking leading questions already knowing the answer. Yep. What is my opinion on that? To be honest, it's just very dry.
Sure.
There's a way to be calculated and not dry, I'm sure, but this is the best example I could think of. It's just, it comes across to me as not real, and that is something I can't connect to. And when I can't connect to something, I've checked out.
So what I'll offer is the term manipulative. So when they don't stray from the script and it's outcome based, it's manipulative. It's Machiavellian. Right, it's on purpose, and they're really trying to steer you into the spot they want you. Whereas
manipulative or strategic, or can we use it interchangeably here?
I think they're synonymous enough that you can use them, but I think the intent allows for the difference. Strategic could be, I want you to be happy, right? Like, so you could have a positive valence or a positive direction and a negative direction. Yeah. So what I would say is maybe we add power dynamics. So I'm trying to get you to bend to my will so that I win, right? And now it's like, well, you could do that with happiness. I'm like, yeah, that could be very Machiavellian, right? So I think it's maybe the direction. Is it a net benefit for all, or is it a net benefit for one? Right. If it's net benefit for one, I think manipulative would be more important. If it's net benefit for all, I'd say maybe strategic fits better, just because of the way that we would commonly use those words.
Right.
And the reason I say manipulative and talking about connecting, somebody who does the research and knows what they're talking about for the topic, as far as learning is concerned, that's familiarity. That's having a scaffold to hang on so that you can go and have that real live discussion. And now all of a sudden something new can happen because of the interaction. Right. So the ability to move off of the plan, have familiarity. Mm-hmm. So your constant conversations in your own head, that's familiarity. That's building knowledge. That's building understanding, building semantic network, so that you can have those live interactions that can go in different directions and you can pull back.
Right.
So again, framework, scaffolding, knowing the target, missing the target, making the correction. It seems to be a fairly good model to explain a lot of things, especially when you're trying to convey a message. We're all trying to convey a message for differing reasons, and that's fantastic.
It's interesting night.
Yeah, I think
it's always interesting when Sam is here.
I mean, I feel interesting.
How do you feel about overly strategic?
I hate them. Oh, sorry. No, strategic, I'm okay. Manipulative, no. That's I say this a lot. My dad being from Detroit, I pretend to blame all this on him, right? Because America, right? But it's really not that. It's much more than that, right? Because because the reality of being in any place is that it's variable. There can be this larger concept that applies relatively well. So, like, Americans like freedom. Mm. It's like, yeah, but some Americans who are trying to take freedom away from other Americans and trying to, you know, so the reality of it is different. But anytime I feel manipulated, anytime somebody is, I identify that somebody is trying to remove my freedom of choice, I am ready to fight.
So if I go with the word strategic, does someone that appears to be overly strategic, does that change your trust in them?
So I believe I detect that it's a net benefit for many versus a net benefit for them. Mm-hmm. Let's just say I also have an understanding of why they want it to be a net. So if it's a net benefit for them and not many, it's going to bother me.
Okay.
If I understand to some, or I believe to some degree that I understand what has generated their desire for a net benefit for them. Yeah. So let's just say they've really had a problem in their life and it kind of does a good job of explaining why they're trying to get this benefit.
Right.
I think I have more pathos.
Okay.
But if it's just because they're a privileged dick, no, I don't like that. So it's, I think it's maybe more contextual. If I have a little bit more context, I understand it. What I've learned about myself and about life is instead of jumping to, so the, I have a way that I talk about this. It's basically like, listen, you can shit on anybody's lawn, but if you shit on mine, we have to at least have a conversation so I figure out, so I learn whether or not we have to fight.
Right.
If you just had explosive diarrhea because of a medication, I'm like, okay, well, man, that sucks. Like, hey, can we clean this up?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Versus, no, I shit on your lawn because I don't like the way you look.
Right.
It's like, okay, we have to fight. Right. So if I've learned to pause a little bit longer, try to figure out what the motivation is. And if the motivation is one that I disagree with, we fight. And it doesn't mean fist fight. It means have discord.
Right.
If it's, if like, oh man, something really messed up happened and this is an accident. All right, let's fix it. Right. Let's fight is also let's fix it because don't do that to me. Right, so I need to deter you from doing that again because I don't want it again.
Right.
So I need to prune the behavior in some way.
Interesting. You're an interesting dude.
I mean, again, I think so. It would be nice if other people agreed with me more about me being interesting. But
other people don't think you're interesting?
I told you and you decided to steal the line, is my personality is a really good triage mechanism.
That's a fucking fabulous line. I'm going to use that forever, by the way.
Well, I think all of ours are. But depending on how you present yourself, it's more likely to work quickly. Because of my preference for accuracy, because of my preference for directness, my friends tend to relish when something ridiculous happens and I notice it. Because if I don't notice it, I don't do anything. But if I notice it, like you see how my metaphor about like if you shit in front of me and I see it, okay, we have to talk.
Right.
Like it's really quick. I'm better at not being rough about it than I used to be. It used to be faster and rougher. Now it's a little bit more considered and like, wait a minute, what happened? Right. But it's
why
still
the change
because I recognized that it wasn't getting to my general goal of being positive and helpful. Like I'd like to be nice.
Right.
But I mean, if I shouldn't be nice, I'm not going
to
be nice.
It was like the reverse triage. Although people were being turned away, he was realizing I didn't mean to turn them away.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to do that.
Is it difficult for you to be nice?
No. I think I'm nice all the time.
Right.
The people.
What did Andre call you?
Interesting?
No, he said so. It was about you.
Is it difficult for you to be perceived as nice?
No. So interestingly, across my lifespan, you know the characteristics that generally
lovable.
Society...
He called him lovable.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. Right? But the general...
You were there.
Yeah, no, I just didn't... Well, like, listen, I don't remember everything. But the general characteristics most cultures would say you should have, you know, being conscientious, being helpful, you know, things like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I display those regularly, but through my lifespan, I haven't necessarily gotten the feedback from the world that you would suspect you would get from having those as being the positive things in society.
Do you think that's a them problem or a you problem?
Oh, I do think it's a them problem.
And do we think it's a them problem because them don't like to be... So, you know, you were talking about how you'll be direct.
Yeah.
And you like accuracy. And I've always appreciated that. But I mean, I joke with you all the time. I'm like, every time I'm with you, I learn something.
Yeah.
And it's because in just regular conversation, one thing I picked up on you very quickly when we met is that if somebody says something and they might be saying it as a very black and white statement and you'll be like, well, and then you throw in the nuance.
Yeah. Trying to be helpful.
And you're trying to be helpful.
Yes.
Not all people respond well to that.
Yes.
Like for me, I'm happy when I am the first person to say, like, I didn't know that. You just taught me something today. And it's interesting. But there are people who are like, I don't always want someone to correct me.
Yep.
And so I laughed so much at the triage comics.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, I find them that way too. I just recently was told by somebody, and it's absolutely true. I never really thought of myself that way, but that my humor is very often self-deprecating and some people really hate that. I'm like, yeah, you know what? I annoy people. Like for sure.
Yeah.
And I never thought about it. And I was like, huh? Yeah. If you really don't like that within like 10 minutes of meeting me, you're going to get it.
Yeah. So, what I would say is that I'm okay with the normal outcomes of being me.
Mm.
And it was just, there was a period of time where I was like, I feel like that I should be getting a different form of feedback. And so then the question for me was, should I like myself? Because I always liked myself. But then there was a question for a period of time, should I like myself?
Right.
And I was like, yes. Right. So I do. But I also understand the difficulty that people seem to display. So because I'm not trying to put them into a situation where they're having a hard time with me, I attempt to adjust. Because if I can see that I'm missing my intended mark, I'd like to adjust.
Mm.
Right. So I've actually had that as a compliment. It's like when I tell you that I don't like something, you change it. I'm like, well, yeah, I care about you.
Mm.
Right. So it's just interesting that way, because I do believe, and I'm willing to say that I could be wrong, because anything that I think about myself could be wrong. We're all poor judges of ourselves, because every thought we think we're right.
Mm.
Well, not every thought. We can often think we're wrong, but then that's usually depression. But it's more like, you know, I like myself, and I have this target of trying to be generally positive and helpful. But sometimes being positive and helpful means helping you face the consequences of doing something that's incorrect.
Mm.
Yeah.
And sometimes that means being rough with people.
I realized, by the way, through this conversation, I won't get into a whole new thread. We can talk later. But I realized through this that what I used to think, I used to wonder sometimes if I was manipulative. And I've now decided I'm strategic and not manipulative.
Sure.
But I mean, when it comes to like what you said, is this good for many or just for me? In many situations, I tend to have a way of taking over a situation without necessarily outwardly saying, I'm taking control of this.
Yeah.
I just end up doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And usually doing it is because I can't handle the chaos. But the outcome is always everybody else is happier because I've eliminated the chaos.
Yeah.
But I used to think it was manipulation, because I find a way to be like, I'm going to just make this my way now.
Well, you know that the outcome goal is to attempt to make it succeed. You see it not succeeding, so you start to inject behavior that will help it succeed without being negative.
So I'm not manipulative. I'm strategic.
Yeah. And now, to be fair, other people might lose it about the manner in which the terms are being used. But the way that language develops in a meaningful way is shared definition.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right. So at least within this small period of time, within this small group of people,
how we're using it right now.
Yeah.
This
right
is
now.
The definition right
but
now.
But that's why you need definitions.
Yeah.
And when you try to take away definitions and say words mean whatever I say they mean, then all of a sudden let's not. But then
that's for another 2 hours.
No, but then you have a lot of discord and a lot of confusion. Yep. And how would you expect people to get along? Now, if the goal is for people to get along, regardless of whatever characteristic is being displayed or whatever topic is being talked about, come to some agreed definition. But everybody gets a say.
Mm.
And now the agreement won't be perfect. Of course, it's a trade-off and a compromise.
Yeah.
But I mean, at least you came to some agreement. It's like, okay, fine. When I'm around you, I'll say it this way.
Fine.
Yeah.
This was good, man. Thanks for
coming
in. Very good.
Thanks for hanging out again. And by the way, not that I didn't believe you guys, but I did go back into our catalog, because I swear I had such a strong memory of Sam being on our couch before. But yeah, it's just because you hang out here so much that you were just sitting here hanging out.
It was because it's Monica's desk.
Yes, exactly.
And then there's wine.
And there's wine, and yeah.
You're my new drinking buddy.
Oh, boy.
I love it when Sam gets drunk.
We better end this right here. Things are going to go south.
Right on. You guys have been listening to Two Massage Therapists and a Microphone. Peace.